attacked the city of Idlib and was able to take full control of it in a short time. Idlib is the provincial capital of the province of Idlib in northwestern Syria. It borders Turkey, and its proximity to the coastal provinces gives it a strategic position. Jaysh al-Fatah continued its advances in Idlib province, and after a short time, it conquered the city of Cisrashughur. With the fall of Cisrashughur, the cities of Fo'a and Kafaria faced a critical situation. Fo'a and Kafaria are two Shia-dominated cities in Idlib province, which were completely besieged by Jaysh al-Fatah. The residents of Fo'a and Kafaria knew that if the cities fell, Nusra Front forces would massacre everyone. That's why they resisted tooth and nail. When there was no way of delivering aid to these cities, Iranian military transport planes took over the responsibility of sending aid to the cities so that the people could resist for a longer time. The rapid withdrawal of the Syrian army from Idlib province showed that the Syrian army was incapable of confronting the forces of Jaysh al-Fatah. Because Idlib shares a border with Turkey, Nusra Front and Ahrar al-Sham were well backed by Turkey, and this made taking back these regions difficult. At this stage, the advances of Jaysh al-Fatah toward Aleppo or the coastal provinces had to be stopped. For this reason, on the order of General Soleimani, a new phase of organizing forces under Iranian command began. Initially, the involvement of the Iranian Air Force in Syria was raised, but General Soleimani did not consider it suitable. So the Iranians decided to persuade Russia to send its air force to Syria. The Russians had a strong interest in maintaining the government of Bashar Assad because Syria had long been Russia's strategic base in the Middle East. Aside from that, the large number of Chechen forces among Salafi armed groups in Syria had made confronting them one of Russia's national security priorities.
If you go to Moscow, and I do, and you go and see the Kremlin, you look over the Kremlin wall, due south, you see Chechnya, which Putin is still very worried about as a seat of Islamic revolution, you see. And Putin, if you keep on looking beyond Chechnya, you see the minarets of Damascus.
General Qasem Soleimani recently visited Moscow to meet with senior Russian leaders.
At the time, some news agencies reported that General Soleimani had met with Putin, a meeting which was aimed at convincing Putin of military intervention in Syria. Participation of the Russian Air Force, the Iranians also increased the size of their forces in Syria. The new forces that had come from Iran were no longer just advisors, but were organized in the form of combat forces. The IRGC now commanded a front consisting of multinational ground forces and was supported by the Russian Air Force. This powerful combination could change the balance of power on the battlefield in favor of the Syrian government, and it was natural that it would lead to the opposition of countries that supported the armed opposition. Turkey was angrier than any other country at the presence of the Russian Air Force. Its president Erdogan knew that the presence of Iranian forces and Russian air support could make things difficult for the Nusra Front and Ahrar al-Sham. But this was not the only problem Turkey had. On October the 10th, 2015, the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces announced their formation in the city of Hasaka. The main structure of these forces was the Kurdish defenders of the city of Kobani. They had previously been supported by the Syrian army and the IRGC in the fight against Daesh, but now they had gotten closer to the Americans. Because these forces were openly supported by the U.S. and the Syrian government did not want to directly engage the U.S., it avoided taking a clear stance against them. The priority of the Syrian army at this time was to eliminate the Takfiri groups. But the formation of these forces angered Turkey. A large part of the Syrian Democratic Forces was made up of fighters from the PKK, which Turkey had designated as a terrorist group. Now, the Americans were strengthening them along the borders of Turkey, and this was not acceptable to the Turkish government. All of this had exacerbated Erdogan's stance against the US and Russia. On November the 24th, 2015, a Russian Air Force Sukhoi 24 aircraft was shot down by a Turkish plane in the north of Syria. Turkey's prime minister announced that the aircraft had ignored warnings and entered Turkish soil for 17 seconds. The two pilots of the aircraft ejected. One of them was found by Russian patrols, but the other one was killed by Nusra Front forces. Vladimir Putin explicitly stated that the incident would not go unanswered and demanded an official apology from the Turks. On the other side, Erdogan not only did not apologize, but also warned that it would be better for Russia not to play with fire. Erdogan was almost certain that in the event of a Russian response, NATO forces would intervene in support of the Turkish army. But instead of a military response, Putin imposed a series of economic sanctions on Turkey. He banned the import of fruits and vegetables from Turkey and stopped the export of gas to the country. On the other hand, he also banned Russian citizens from traveling to Turkey. The sanctions were a severe blow to Turkey's economy, as the country hosted about 4 million Russian tourists a year and imported half of its gas from Russia. All of these pressures prompted Erdogan to formally apologize to Russia, contrary to his pledges, and to announce that he was ready to pay damages for the plane crash and compensate the killing of its pilot. At the same time, the UN Secretary General's envoy called on the influential countries involved in the crisis in Syria to gather in Vienna to find a political solution to the conflict. Although such meetings had been fruitless in the past, the Vienna conference had undergone several changes which may have made a difference. The first feature was the presence of Iran. Until then, because of Iran's insistence on the continued rule of Bashar Assad, the Americans had prevented Iran from being invited to such meetings. But now, after the JCPOA had been signed, the U.S. sought to persuade Iran to change its regional positions. For that reason, it did not object to Iran's invitation to the conference. Even though Syrian opposition groups stated that they will boycott the summit if Iran attended, the UN had not invited any of them to the meeting to begin with. The second feature of the conference was that it coincided with Daesh operations in European cities. A few days before the summit, Paris witnessed a series of unprecedented terrorist operations which Daesh claimed responsibility for. This meant that European countries had more incentives in finding a political solution and ending the crisis in Syria. Therefore, there were possibilities that they may give up some of their strong positions against Bashar Assad. Although the Vienna conference was held with these assumptions, once again the countries influential in the Syrian crisis could not reach a practical agreement. The most important difference, as in the past, were the fate of the legitimate government of Syria and how to deal with terrorist groups. A few days after the Vienna meeting, the Syrian army announced that it had targeted Zahran Alush on the outskirts of Damascus with the cooperation of the Russian Air Force. Zahran Alush was the leader of Jaish al-Islam, which had control of the Ghouta region in the suburbs of Damascus. He was an influential figure among the armed opposition who was openly supported by Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis were trying to convince the international community that he and his group, Jaish al-Islam, were a moderate opposition force. The proximity of the Ghouta region to Damascus and its geological complexity had always been a serious threat to the security of the capital. Therefore, weakening Jaish al-Islam was one of the main priorities of the Syrian army and its allies. Even though Jaish al-Islam immediately announced its new commander, Saudi Arabia knew that it could not easily find a person with the abilities of Zahran Alush. With the death of Alush, the hundreds of millions of dollars spent to strengthen him were practically lost. But Saudi Arabia was reluctant to accept this fact and instead tried to escalate tensions with Iran even higher. A few days after the death of Zahran Alush, Saudi Arabia executed Shia cleric Sheikh Nimran Nimr, who was a critic of the Saudi government. As it was anticipated, the execution of Sheikh Nimr caused the anger of Shias across the world. A group of Iranians gathered in front of the Saudi embassy in Tehran and the Saudi consulate in Mashhad. Their protest gradually escalated into violence, and Iranian police were unable to prevent protesters from entering the Saudi embassy building. The protesters set fire to parts of the Saudi embassy and destroyed its property. Iran announced that it had arrested the protesters and formally condemned their actions. But Saudi Arabia recalled its diplomats from Iran due to insecurity, and diplomatic relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia were completely severed. Some other Arab countries also withdrew their diplomats from Iran in support of Saudi Arabia. As these events were going on, Haj Qasem Soleimani was busy planning the complete liberation of the city. On the other hand, Turkey would under no conditions allow Aleppo to come under the control of the Syrian government. Under these circumstances, the IRGC's Quds force carried out the first phase of the operation to liberate Aleppo in the southwest of the city. During this operation, which was named Nasr, Iranian-led forces were able to retake the strategic city of Khan Tuman from the Jaish al-Fatah and approach the main Aleppo-Hama road. But the beginning of a harsh winter and the arrival of large numbers of troops and weapons from Turkey for Jaish al-Islam forced Iranian-led forces to retreat from Khan Tuman after a while. But Haj Qasem Soleimani immediately implemented the second phase of the operation, this time in eastern Aleppo. In this phase, Iranian-led forces attempted to bypass eastern Aleppo. This operation was carried out on a route that was controlled by Nusra Front on the one end and Daesh on the other. For this reason, everyone thought success would be out of the question. But despite these complexities, Iranian-led forces advanced rapidly and reached Nuble and Az-Zahra in northern Aleppo. With the success of this phase of the operation, Shias living in Nubla and Az-Zahra were liberated from a 3.5-year siege. Now, the city of Aleppo was under siege from the east as well, and this was a great step towards its complete liberation. As the Syrian army and its allies prepared for the Great War in Aleppo, armed Salafi groups began to strengthen their positions inside the city. But this strengthening of positions was not limited to military activities.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen.
In July 2016, Abu Muhammad Julani sent out a video message announcing that the Nusra Front had been disbanded as an al-Qaeda-linked group and had been replaced by a new group with no ties to groups outside Syria. The announcement of the severance of ties with al-Qaeda meant that Fatah al-Sham was supposed to only operate in Syria and did not seek operations around the world like al-Qaeda. Therefore, it should not be recognized as a terrorist group by the international community. The first reactions to this were made by the Free Army. The Free Army, which identified itself as secular, welcomed the renaming of Nusra, calling them the Sons of the Syrian Nation. Differences emerged within the structure of the Nusra Front. It was reported that some figures close to al-Qaeda had decided to leave the movement and wanted to launch a new movement that would remain linked to al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda reacted to stop the disintegration of Nusra. In an effort to silence protesters, Ahmad Abul Khair, the deputy of Ayman al-Zawahiri, announced in an audio message that the renaming of the Nusra Front had been carried out with the coordination and consent of al-Qaeda. All these events caused Western countries to turn away from these changes, and Julani's decision to change the name of the Nusra Front was practically useless. The US explicitly stated that the change would not cause the removal of the group from the list of terrorists. As these events unfolded, Lebanon's Hezbollah held a military parade in the city of Qusair to prepare its forces for the Aleppo War. The parade was characterized by the large presence of armored and heavy weapons, something that did not exist before in Hezbollah's combat structure, which was mainly a resistance group. With the parade, Hezbollah showed that the experience of fighting extremist groups in Syria had turned the movement into a full-fledged army. In these circumstances, Haj Qasem Soleimani ordered the beginning of the Aleppo operation. The first phase of the operation was to complete the siege of the eastern part of Aleppo, which was inhabited by armed Salafi groups. At the time, the only connection path of the armed opposition groups was the Castello route in the north of the city. The Castello route connects the eastern region of Aleppo to Idlib province and the Turkish border. The Syrian army announced several safe routes before the operation began so that the residents of eastern Aleppo could leave the area. Some residents used the opportunity and left the militant-held area. They settled in camps set up by the IRGC in the Sheikh Najjar area. At 0 hour of the operation, the Syrian army and its allies launched an offensive to liberate Castello route. The attack was supported by the Russian Air Force. The armed opposition knew that the loss of Castello route could bring them closer to losing the entire city of Aleppo. That's why they came to the battlefield with all their might. despite all their efforts, the Syrian army and forces under Iranian command liberated Castella Route, and the eastern region of Aleppo was completely besieged. With the completion of the siege of Aleppo, the second phase of the operation began. The purpose of this phase was to liberate the northern neighborhoods and tighten the siege. Before the start of this phase, the people living in the east of Aleppo were once again given the opportunity to leave the city. The Nusra Front and Ahrar al-Sham, which were planning a major operation aimed at breaking the siege of Aleppo, repeatedly promised the people that the siege of the city would be broken soon. Based on these promises, some of the remaining people in the city who were ideologically close to the armed groups refused to leave Aleppo. At the same time, political and media pressures intensified to prevent the complete liberation of Aleppo. Western media outlets regularly reported from inside Aleppo, in which the residents were asking for help.
It's the last days.
The presence of foreign members of Al-Qaeda on well-known international media outlets had turned into an ordinary event and asking for help from the people.
It's the last time that I talk to you.
People are executed. It's as simple as that.
Turkey and Germany plan to seek...
On the other hand, Turkey and some European countries called for NATO intervention to prevent the liberation of Aleppo.
Speaking after meeting Angela Merkel in Ankara, Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet...
Even the UN Security Council sought to pass a resolution for international intervention in Aleppo, which was vetoed by Russia.
In short, it is difficult to deny that Russia is partnering with the Syrian regime to carry out war crimes.
What Russia is sponsoring and doing is not counterterrorism, it is barbarism.
Thanks to this international support, Jaish al-Fatah moved from Idlib province to the southwest of Aleppo with all its might. Their goal was to break the siege of the eastern part. In a fierce battle, Jaish al-Fatah succeeded in breaking the siege of the eastern part of the city by occupying the Ramuse district and the military academy. Now they had to maintain this area so that the process of sending equipment to the forces present in eastern Aleppo could continue. On the other side of the battle, the Syrian army and its allies had to liberate the Ramuse district any way they could. Because without besieging the eastern part, there was no way to completely liberate the city. But this was very difficult because the Nusra Front and Ahrar al-Sham had stationed large numbers of troops and equipment in the area. General Soleimani put Iranian forces in charge of liberating these areas, and heavy battles between the Nusra Front and Ahrar al-Sham began in Ramuse. This fierce battle lasted for 40 days, but eventually extremist Salafi groups retreated with very high casualties, and once again the siege of the eastern part was completed. With the completion of the siege of the city, the process of liberating the eastern part began neighborhood by neighborhood. At this point, the residents of the city were once again given the opportunity to leave. These residents were mostly family members of armed opposition groups. They themselves were now sure that they could not resist any longer. That's why they sent their families to Idlib on buses provided by the Syrian government. After the families left, the process of liberating the city accelerated and the neighborhoods were liberated one after another. Things got to the point where several thousand gunmen stationed in the city gathered in one neighborhood. They then sought the help of Turkey to create a situation for their safe exit from the city. Erdogan agreed with Putin that the militants hand over their heavy weapons to be allowed to leave Aleppo and go to Idlib. But the agreement between Turkey and Russia was unacceptable to Iran. At the time, thousands of Shias living in Foa and Kafaria were besieged by Jaish al-Fatah for a long time. And if the armed forces were allowed to leave, in return, a part of the residents of Foa and Kafaria had to be released from the siege. In Iran's opinion, Russia's action was a gift to the armed opposition without getting anything back in return. The day after the Turkish-Russian agreement was announced, the first group of militants, who were 1,250 in number, left Aleppo. But General Soleimani ordered the remaining militants to be prevented from leaving, and the Russian-Turkish agreement was effectively annulled. Under General Soleimani's leadership, the Iranians directly contacted Ahrar al-Sham officials who were following the issue of the withdrawal of the militants in order to facilitate the exchange of the residents of Foa and Kafaria with the militants of Aleppo. This was the first direct contact between Iranian forces and extremist Salafi groups. In the end, it was agreed that in exchange for the militants in Aleppo, 3,000 Shia residents of Foa and Kafaria were liberated from the siege. With the exit of all militants from Aleppo, the city was totally liberated from occupation after 5 years. Analysts deemed the complete liberation of Aleppo as a sign of the beginning to resolve the crisis in Syria.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa
The status of a teacher and a student is that these two together change the way of thinking of the nation. Their affair is such an affair which needs special attention. The pensions of teacher and student should be fixed so that Allah willing, these people are mankind's judges. The way Islam desires, act that way and pass through stages to reach that which is the destination of man.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Islam and our deeds. Before this episode, we just finished the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the search of Islam. Now, we are entering into a new chapter, which is known as Islam and our deeds. In one of these speeches, Imam Khomeini said that today Islam depends on our deeds. Now, this is very much clear because we are the face of Islam. Being Muslims, we are those to whom people like. They see, they look at us, they note our actions, and everything is being noticed. Therefore, it is our deeds and our actions which portray the true face of Islam. Therefore, we need to be very much careful. And even before that, we need to learn about Islam. We need to get knowledgeable about the Islam. If we do not have the knowledge of Islam, we cannot perform the deeds according to the teachings. And that is the main point. We can see that there are other religions, the followers of other religions, for example, the Christianity, for example, the Judaism, how they changed their religion, how they make changes into the holy books which were sent by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi. Sallallahu alayhi.
Today, if we can see the face of Christianity to be in this way, it is because of the followers of that religion. And even the Judaism, if it is like this, it is because of their followers. Therefore, Islam depends on our deeds. And that's what Imam Khomeini is saying. Imam Khomeini, basically, he wants to say that you need to learn, you need to spend some time in order to learn about the Islamic rules, about the Islam. You should know what Islam says. When you're out there with your family, how you should act. When you're within the people, in the society, how should you act and how should you deal when you are obviously in an area, for example, in an environment, specific environment, how you should live. This has all been said in Islam. And if we are unaware of those things, then obviously by just calling ourselves Muslim, it is not enough. Therefore, we need to be very much careful, because tomorrow if something happens to the name of Islam, because of us, we are the ones who are guilty. And we need to accept this mistake that we have done, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. According to the UN, in 2021, 342 Palestinians, most of them civilians, were killed by the Zionist regime across Palestine, including 86 children. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you, written by Jessica Baxbaum, journalist. This article is titled, Zionist Regime Violence Intensifying as 2021 Proves Deadliest for Palestinians Since 2014. Stay tuned for more. On December 10th, Jamil Abu Ayyash, 31, was shot in the head by the Zionist regime troops during anti-settlement demonstrations in Beita, a village south of Nablus in the occupied West Bank. Abu Ayyash succumbed to his injuries. 3 days later, the Zionist regime army fatally shot Jamil al-Kayal, also 31, in the head during an early morning raid in Nablus. And the beginning of December was marked by two other killings within 2 days of each other. On December 4th, the Zionist regime border police shot and killed Muhammad Shaukat Salama, 23. And on December 6th, the Zionist regime guards fatally shot 16-year-old Muhammad Nidal Yunus. The latest string of killings by the Zionist regime forces follows the same predictable pattern of Israeli regime violence against Palestinians, but with one significant distinction. The Zionist regime's violence is intensifying, as 2021 is proving to be the deadliest for Palestinians since 2014. In its latest Protection of Civilians report, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, said that more than 70 Palestinians have been killed by the Zionist regime forces in the West Bank and occupied East al-Quds this year. This figure stands in stark contrast to previous years. In 2020, 24 Palestinians were killed in the West Bank, and in 2019, 27 were killed. Concerns about excessive use of force by Israeli troops resulting in the killing or serious injury of Palestinians, as well as lack of accountability for such violations of international law, remain, OCHA wrote in its 2022 humanitarian needs overview for the occupied Palestinian territories. In 2021, over 1,000 have been injured by live ammunition, it added. The UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, also raised concerns over the shooting death of Salama at Damascus Gate earlier this month, calling it an apparent extrajudicial execution. In a Facebook post, OHCHR questioned, "Extrajudicial killings such as this are the consequence of the regular resort to lethal force by well-armed and well-protected Israeli security personnel against Palestinians, and the almost total lack of accountability for killings and injuries of Palestinians by Israeli forces. Will there be accountability in this case?" In Gaza, civilian casualties are just as alarming. A study by AirWars, a nonprofit tracking civilian harm, revealed Israeli regime strikes on Gaza killed up to 10 times more civilians during its 11-day assault in May than had its 8-year bombing campaign against forces in Syria. The researchers found Israeli regime airstrikes killed between 151 and 192 civilians in Gaza, a third of whom were children. The Zionist regime army often justified its military actions in Gaza as targeting militants. But Air Wars found that in over 80% of attacks against civilians, no member of militants were reported injured or killed. According to UN data, 2021 has seen the most Palestinian casualties since 2014, when the Zionist regime launched a war against Gaza known as Operation Protective Edge. In 2021, to date, 342 Palestinians have been killed by the Zionist regime across Palestine. This year's Israeli regime violence stems mostly from the Israeli assault on Gaza in May and the ongoing anti-colonization protests in Beita. Abu Ayyash was the ninth Palestinian to be killed since May by the Zionist regime troops during the weekly demonstrations. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights, PCHR, asserted excessive force was used in Abu Ayyash's death, writing in a press release that the Israeli regime army directly targeted the Palestinian civilians in the head. In its statement, PCHR detailed that an eyewitness said to PCHR's field worker that an Israeli troop fired two bullets from 40 to 50 meters on the top of the mound. One of the bullets was in the air, while the other hit Jamil Abu Ayyash, who was in front of the troop trying to turn back and fled away. Meanwhile, Abu Ayyash did not pose any imminent threat to the troops' lives. Abu Ayyash was shot in the back of the head and fell on the ground. PCHR reiterated, "These crimes reflect the excessive use of force in circumstances where there was no imminent threat to the troops' lives and prove the Zionist regime occupation forces lenient shooting standards against the Palestinian civilians." Beita's deputy mayor, Musa Hamayel, described the protest against the establishment of Aviatar outpost as peaceful marches. "We haven't used any kind of weapon against settlers. All that happens on the mountain is peaceful, popular resistance," Musa told Minpress News, adding, "just burning tires and using some torches and lights." Musa explained, referring to the night confusion method of protesting, "This form of demonstration incorporates sound and light to disturb the nearby settlers. Because Israel is convinced of the importance of this outpost for the Israeli side, they use violence." The Zionist regime army has tried suppressing the protest with tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets, which Musa said are being aimed at the upper body parts of the protesters, including their hands. The UN's Chemical Weapons Convention in 1993 banned the use of riot control agents like tear gas in warfare, and 2018 Geneva guidelines stipulate rubber-coated steel bullets should be fired toward the lower parts of the body and not aimed at the head. All nine Palestinians killed in Beita this year were shot with live fire either in the head, chest, or abdomen. The Israeli regime army did not respond to requests for comment on its use of rubber-coated steel bullets against Beita residents. Documentation from non-governmental organization Defense for Children International Palestine, DCIP reported 86 Palestinian children have been killed in the occupied Palestinian territory since January, making 2021 the deadliest year on record for Palestinian children since 2014. According to DCIP, the Zionist regime forces killed 76 Palestinian children, 61 in Gaza and 15 in the West Bank and East Al-Quds. The Zionist regime forces killed 17 Palestinian children using live ammunition in 2021, with at least 9 fatally shot during demonstrations or clashes. In its press release, DCIP wrote, "Under international law, intentional lethal force is only justified in circumstances where a direct threat to life or of serious injury is present. However, investigations and evidence collected by DCIP suggest that Israeli forces use lethal force against Palestinian children in circumstances that may amount to extrajudicial or willful killings." Ayat Abu Ertiash, Accountability Program Director at DCIP, added, "The international community's lack of political will to hold Israeli officials accountable guarantees that Israeli troops will continue to unlawfully kill Palestinian children with impunity." Saeed Hamayel understands the pain of losing a child. The father of 5 lost his firstborn, Mohammed Saeed Hamayel, on June 11th, when the Zionist regime troops shot the 16-year-old in the chest during the protests in Beitar. Saeed described how the single bullet that hit Mohammed caused damage to his heart and lungs, fractured parts of his rib cage, and created a 3-inch hole in his body. "They shot him with live fire in order to kill him," Saeed said. "It was an intentional killing." Saeed said the Zionist regime army never gave an explanation for his son's killing. The Zionist regime army did not respond to main press requests for comment on minors killed during the Beitar protests.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's topic, housing in Islamic culture. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's topic, we will talk about the topic of housing in the Islamic culture. What we can see in the Islamic teachings is that the Islam praises having a big house for those who need it. For example, those who have more children, whose family is big. On top of that, there are some people who require, lifestyle is in a way that they require a big house to live in a big house. So they can have it and it is praised. But on top of that, the structure of the houses should be in a way that it should show some kind of Islamic lifestyle. Generally, what we can see in today's world is people are living in the small compounds, people are living in the apartments, or maybe even they have houses. It is made on the basis or the structure which is being introduced by the West or maybe by a specific religion. Whereas when we talk about the Islamic housing and the structure of the house, when we say it should be Islamic, it means that it should have enough room for everyone. It should have enough room, enough place for the parents to live in a house. It should be having a specific place for praying. It should have a specific place for children to play and a specific place for everyone to get together in the family. And if they have some guests, so they should have a guest room as well. So when we talk Islamically, it looks at all aspects of the life within the house. And when it talks about the structure of the house, it says it should be vast in this way, that there everyone have a specific room or everyone has their own place. And for everything, you have space available in your house. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the housing in the Islamic culture. And obviously, we said that the vast houses or big houses is praised, but according to the conditions that we have, so that it is not against the justice. On top of that, when we talk about the structure of the houses or the building itself, we said that it should have enough room for praying. It should have a specific room, specific place. Now, when we generally go and look at the, in the Islamic world, when we look at the old houses, I generally have experienced it, and I really liked it, that when it is said that there should be a room for prayer, they used to have a room. Even those who go for the pilgrimage, and they might have gone to the house of Imam Ali in the Kufa, and the other a'imma, like the other houses, they would have seen that there is a specific place for praying. And this place was specifically made in the houses, a kind of sanctuary within the house, or a kind of place which used to show the side of Qibla, that this is the way you need to face and pray. And there was a specific place or room, a small room, praying room in the houses previously, where people used to go and pray. And that's why when it was the time to, for example, like for someone to pass away, they used to say to take him to the place where he used to pray. So even in the rooms, in the houses, there was a specific sign, a specific room, small room for praying. In the old Islamic culture, we can see whole houses. Maybe if you visit Iran or other Islamic countries, you might have seen this. And on top of that, the courtyard, especially big courtyards with the trees and all those things, which was a kind of peace. It was a kind of happiness. But we do not find the same peace and happiness in today's world when we are moved into the apartments, when we are moved into the small compounds, when we are moved into the place where we are living in sharing. And this way we are harming ourselves. The stress is increasing in our life. The sickness is increasing. We are not satisfied with what we have. We do not have peace. Therefore, it is necessary to live according to the teachings of Islam. Even when you're about to buy a house or rent a house, choose a house which is according to the teachings of Islam, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.